Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on Bethesda University v. Cho, featuring Ryan Gardner. Our moderator today is Professor William Robert Wagner. Professor Wagner is a WFFC Distinguished Chair at Spring Arbor University, Counselor of the Ministry and President Emeritus at Salt and Light Global, and Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Western Michigan University, Cooley Law School. He is also a former federal judge, an author, a well-renowned speaker, a former diplomat, and many other things that we don't have time to recount in today's program. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Professor Wagner, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Hey, folks. It's a privilege to moderate this session today, and it is a deep honor and privilege to introduce Ryan Gardner. In February 2022, Ryan joined First Liberty Institute as counsel after spending over 4 years at a large Dallas law firm. And there he handled complex commercial disputes, both, you know, at the trial level and in the appellate courts. Before his time in private practice, Ryan worked in Washington, D.C. as a law clerk to the Honorable Janice Rogers Brown of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And so we are here today with a very accomplished lawyer. Ryan graduated as valedictorian from Pepperdine Law School, where he served as lead articles editor for the Pepperdine Law Review and president of the Pepperdine chapter of the Federalist Society. So, member of the Texas Bar, he's admitted to practice in various federal and appellate courts. And so, welcome, Ryan, today. He is here to discuss the Bethesda University versus Chow case, because Liberty has a petition before the U.S. Supreme Court, asking the court to hear that case. Bethesda University was a private Christian university. It was founded around a Pentecostal theology. And at some point, it faced an internal leadership dispute. And the president there, what happened was the president persuaded the board to appoint non-Pentecostal members to the board. And now we are, you know, this case has woven its way to the Supreme Court with very, very interesting First Amendment issues that I'm going to let Ryan tell you more about. So without further ado, Ryan, why don't you get us started by telling us a little bit about, you know, how did Bethesda University v. Chow, how did this case get started in the first place?
Absolutely. And I'd like to start just by thanking everybody for taking the time out of their busy schedules to be a part of this event today. I know, especially during the holiday seasons, everybody is very busy. And so your attendance is greatly appreciated to talk about this really interesting case. Frankly, it raises some issues in a doctrinal area that the Supreme Court hasn't touched since the 1970s, I believe. So it's one of those areas that we really believe is ripe for clarification, if nothing else, from the high court. But really, at the core of this case is a question of who should be in charge of deciding leadership disputes of religious institutions. And there's sort of two ways that you can look at this case. On one side, there's this thought that this is nothing more than your run-of-the-mill corporate governance dispute. And that's something that courts are well equipped to handle across the country. They do it all the time. And all they're going to do is apply the same sort of doctrinal and statutory law of their states regarding corporate governance. Or is it something more? Is it a case that implicates the very reasons for the creation of the First Amendment? And First Liberty argues the latter in our cert petition. At its core, we view this case as presenting the question of, does the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine bar courts from adjudicating the religious qualifications of leaders for religious institutions? And at the outset, as we're talking about these this doctrine of ecclesiastical abstention, I want to note that if you read the various opinions around the country on this, that courts have interchangeably used two terms. Sometimes they say ecclesiastical abstention, and sometimes they say church autonomy. And both of those mean the same thing. And frankly, church autonomy, ecclesiastical abstention is a mouthful. So I prefer church autonomy for no other reason than that. But the two doctrines mean the same thing. So going a bit into a bit more detail about the factual background of this case, Bethesda University is a small private Pentecostal university located in Anaheim, California. And yes, I mean that Anaheim. So this place is just a couple miles up the road from Disneyland. And it was founded by a Pentecostal South Korean megachurch in the 1970s. And like most universities, it's governed by a board of directors. And this case involves a dispute between two competing boards, who I will call the Kim board and the Chow board. And First Liberty represents the Kim board, just to make that clear from the outset. And so to be a member of the board, according to the university's governing documents, there are certain religious requirements that those documents impose, including having a high level of spiritual development and integrity defined in terms of evangelical and a charismatic understanding and style of life. Those governing documents emphasize a need for those who have been involved in Christian ministry and for their board members to exhibit a theology consistent with the theological position of Bethesda University, and requires them to sign a statement of faith. And this dispute arose when Bethesda's former president, President Chow, convened a board meeting in June 2021 and convinced a bare quorum of the board to elect six new board members, including four who were Presbyterian and not Pentecostal. And I will call that is the Chow board, the board that includes the non-Pentecostal members. And this was something that the board had never done through the history of this university. And it was done in part based upon representations by President Chow that this needed to be done in order to keep the university's accreditation. And so after they did this, the board decided to revisit this issue 10 months later, and they reconvened and they removed the Presbyterian board members, finding that they were ineligible from the start to ever serve because they did not meet those religious qualifications of the university. And that decision to remove those board members set off an internal governance dispute back and forth that ultimately led to the university siding with the Kim board and also firing President Chow.
Ryan, let me stop you for a second, just to be clear that dispute, though, over religion was that it specifically they weren't part of the Pentecostal theology. They had not adopted that, you know, statement of faith and that part, that belief system. Correct.
Yes. It was all about the fact that they were not Pentecostal and therefore were ineligible.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so after that, after this struggle and the university sort of coming down and deciding how it was going to resolve this dispute by firing President Chow and appointing a new president, at that point, the Chow board filed a lawsuit in California State Court, who ultimately ruled in favor of the Chow board and reinstated them. So what you're having here is a situation where the university dealt with the dispute internally, came to a decision, and in the university's mind had essentially resolved the dispute and was moving forward with the Kim board. And the Chow board was agreed by that decision and decided to go to court to challenge it. And they did, and they got a favorable ruling that resulted in the trial court reinstating the Chow board. And what the trial court found is that the university's religious requirements were essentially aspirational, is what the court said. And the court also stated that it was unworkable to have those course of these kinds of standards if there is a conflict that arose, like it did in this case, between competing factions. And the court also found that nothing prevented anyone who was Protestant in general from serving on the board. So in the court's mind, basically, as long as you're Protestant, you're close enough to Pentecostal that you're okay according to the governing documents. And the court found this to not be a theological dispute. Well, the Kim board obviously appealed this decision to the California Court of Appeals, and that court affirmed the trial court's decision. It found that it had jurisdiction to hear this matter because, again, it did not find it to be a theological dispute. And instead, it applied what is called the neutral principles of law doctrine, which we'll get into a little bit later, to interpret the university's governing documents. And at the end of the day, it agreed with the trial court's determination regarding the qualifications for Bethesda University's board members. And at that point, the University of the Kim board appealed to the California Supreme Court and petitioned for review, and the California Supreme Court declined to do so, which has now led us to where we are now, which is a cert petition is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court.
So Ryan, you know, normally when we have a First Amendment case, you have some kind of government authority out there acting, and it's alleged to their action or their conduct is alleged to substantially interfere with, you know, the free exercise of religious conscience or something like that. And yeah. And here though, the government actor is really the court though, isn't it? You know, because, you know, perhaps they should not have brought a case in the first place, or even if they did bring a case in the first place, are you suggesting maybe the court should have just said, hey, wait a minute. It's nice that you guys are bringing this case, but under the First Amendment, we have no authority to decide it. Is that basically what you're saying?
I think that's a fair way to put it. And so when we're dealing with the church autonomy doctrine, what it does is it protects religious institutions' rights to decide for themselves, free from state interference, including civil court interference, matters of church governance and faith and doctrine. And so this doctrine is really founded in both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. I think that this doctrine in particular is a prime example of the complementary purposes of these two clauses of the First Amendment. In the Kennedy case that came out a couple terms ago, Justice Gorsuch talked about this very thing, how you shouldn't read the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause as being in tension with one another, but rather you should look at them as having complementary purposes. And here, you have those complementary purposes in the church autonomy doctrine. It would be an establishment of religion for the government to come in and dictate how a church is supposed to run, who is supposed to lead it, what it's supposed to preach, you know, and also inhibit the free exercise of religion by preventing a church from having its own governance and living out its faith according to the dictates of its own conscience.
Yeah. I got a question from one of the people that are on this webinar, and they say, please clarify, are the members of the Kim board also members of the Chow board?
There is some overlap with a couple members, but the tension is obviously with the president and the ones who were removed. But there was some overlay between the two as far as like what ultimately has happened now. But the bottom line is with the Chow board, the president and his side is basically in control. And so to the extent that there is overlap, the Kim board and any residual Kim board members would be in the minority, essentially.
Good.
And so going back to the church autonomy, ironically, in this case, if you think about it, this is the very wall of separation that Jefferson was talking about in that letter.
Exactly.
To the ministers. And so I know that our friends on the other side often latch onto this wall of separation language and have used it to justify the Lemon Test and everything that came from all of that for the past several decades, talking about this wall of separation. But really what we're talking about is keeping the government out of church. And that's what the church autonomy doctrine is designed to do. It is a jurisdictional bar from adjudicating these types of religious disputes. And this doctrine dates back all the way to 1871. I think the seminal case on this is Watson v. Jones. And what the court said in that case is that it would be lead to the total subversion of religious bodies if anyone aggrieved by one of their decisions could appeal to secular courts to undermine those decisions. And if you think about it, that's exactly what we're dealing with here. We had a dispute arise at Bethesda University. Internally, there was some back and forth strife. The university ultimately came down in favor of the Kim board and put them into power. And then the Chow board, who were aggrieved by that decision, went to a state civil court. And that civil court reached a different decision and has now reinstated someone that the university explicitly decided was not eligible to be in a leadership position at the university.
Well, and over throughout history since 1871, courts have intervened in many church disputes if they can resolve the matter using secular legal principles without getting into the religious doctrine, you know, or beliefs. That's that neutral principles of law that it sounds like the court used here, or the California court used here. Why doesn't that apply in this case? And I believe you'd address some circuit splits with regard to the application of that neutral principles of law doctrine.
Absolutely. And so when we're dealing with the neutral principles doctrine, it's important to realize where that came from. What are the historical underpinnings? What are the doctrinal underpinnings of that? And it dates back to cases in which the Supreme Court crafted an exception to the general rule of church autonomy, which is that it doesn't have jurisdiction to adjudicate religious disputes, to allow for courts to adjudicate church property disputes. And what the court found there is that the resolution of such church property disputes does not implicate theological or doctrinal determinations and was therefore not in tension with church autonomy. And now the court has not always just automatically allowed for church property disputes to be adjudicated. There are instances where the court has refused to exercise jurisdiction because in resolving a property dispute, even it would have to resolve underlying theological matters. And sometimes that would take the form of, by resolving a property dispute, that the court would, for example, have to get rid of a bishop or, you know, interfere with church leadership and something like that. And when you sort of went to that next level beyond just pure, you know, deed type information, where you're really, really just applying the neutral general property laws that apply everywhere, that's where the court is really cautious about going beyond that. And in fact, the Supreme Court has never exercised this neutral principles exception to anything that is not a church property dispute. And I would say that there are many lower courts that have followed the court's lead and have cabined this exception to only property disputes. And I think some of the courts that have taken that course include the Sixth Circuit, the DC Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit. And the Eighth Circuit, I think, is particularly interesting here because there's a case, Hutterville versus Sven, that involved a fairly similar issue. It involved a dispute involving the question of which faction of a religious group could control a religious nonprofit. And what the Eighth Circuit said is simply that we don't have jurisdiction to decide this issue pursuant to the church autonomy doctrine. But of course, there are courts that have reached a different conclusion on this matter. And in doing so, it's concerning in many ways because as courts often have a way of doing, they are loath to give up their jurisdiction. They are loath to refuse to hear cases that are brought to them. And so other courts have expanded the neutral principles exception beyond just property disputes and into other areas. And there's been a sort of back and forth ongoing conversation about this among the courts about, are there other areas of law that they could do? I mean, we're talking about governance here, but there's also been back and forth even on something like tort law. And about if the case is a tort case, can the court adjudicate that? This has come up especially in, I think, the defamation context. And there's been a few notable cases even in recent years on that point. I think One of the more recent prominent ones came from the Texas Supreme Court, actually, that involved a defamation claim by a minister who was removed. And the Texas, the Court of Appeals in Texas found it did have jurisdiction, but then the Texas Supreme Court ultimately disagreed and said, no, this exception does not apply to that. You're expanding it out beyond what it was intended to do. But honing back in on our dispute specifically, the Ninth Circuit has reached a different conclusion than some of the other federal circuits that I just mentioned. And the Ninth Circuit is particularly in tension with the Eighth Circuit, I would say, because in the case of Puri versus Kalasa, the court found that it could adjudicate a dispute over board membership. Wow. And so as you can see, there's very much like, there's no way to reconcile those opinions as far as I can see in looking at them. Either the court does have jurisdiction or it does not. And the Ninth Circuit, what it sort of does in its opinion is it did some clever ellipses to cut out the property disputes part and just says neutral principles. And so that's kind of the way that I think that the court went about getting to the conclusion that it did, that it could construe them. And, you know, and it is an open question, I'll say, frankly, about whether or not there's anywhere beyond the church property area. It might be that the reason the Supreme Court has said that is because it has only been presented with cases that involve church property disputes. And so it talked about church property disputes. So it very well could be that there are other areas where the court could say that this exception also applies. But we just don't know because the court hasn't spoken on this doctrine since the 1970s.
But even if it does, your point is that a church's religious tenets, you know, preclude the court from then stepping in and having jurisdiction. And so we have a question from one of the attendees here, and he says, does the First Amendment override the California Corporation Code regulating the governance of religious organizations and other nonprofit organizations? And I think it might be interesting to get into how this case does involve a religious university, you know, but it could involve other nonprofits. This issue could affect other, you know, nonprofits down the road, especially Christian nonprofits. But but address that, because, you know, I see where the question's coming from, but I think it's missing the point that it's the court action here that is causing the problem, not the California code, it's the application of the court applying the California code as opposed to the code itself. Correct? Or you want to get into
those? So I think one way to look at this is it's simply a question of jurisdiction at the outset. Before we get into any of the underlying disputes, any of the new, the really nitty gritty details of the dispute, there's this question at the very outset that the court should ask before getting into that of, do I have jurisdiction? I mean, frankly, this is a question that courts pretty much always ask themselves. I mean, I think that is especially true in federal courts, because federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. And so state courts maybe don't have that same familiarity of this exercise of deciding, do they have jurisdiction or not? And the way that this doctrine is intended to function is to say just at the outset, courts, you are to evaluate your jurisdiction. And if this implicates theological issues, matters of church governance and something like that's religious in nature, you just simply do not have jurisdiction to handle this from the outset. So not so much as overriding, as simply telling the court that you are not the proper forum to adjudicate this kind of matter. Now, ideally, if you're thinking about religious organizations and how do you resolve internal disputes? And I mean, that's got to be made on an organizational by organizational basis. I mean, I think that one of the better ways to approach this is to be very clear in your bylaws and your corporate governance documents about how you would resolve an internal dispute so that you don't end up implicating these sort of First Amendment issues by somebody running to a court. And you could do that with perhaps an arbitration agreement or something else. There's a lot of alternative dispute resolution agreements out there that can be agreed to by the university and its board of directors and anybody else that could provide another forum. So it's really just a question of forum. And perhaps if you're in a different forum that both parties have agreed to, at that point, you could agree also that these sort of corporate governance statutes like the California Corporations Code applies. And that's one of the bases is upon which this can be adjudicated, in addition to the arbitrator keeping in mind the religious nature of this and giving due weight to those important religious aspects of a dispute that might come up.
And let me ask you this then. I suppose that would not preclude then arbitration or mediation done through a church itself or through a church governing system itself, which would be then controlling its own and governing its own tenets, its own religious tenets, and then deciding the dispute, you know, within its own denomination, say, for example.
That's exactly correct. And you bring up an interesting point in the way that you phrase that, because there are many religious organizations and different denominations in particular that have that exact kind of hierarchical way of resolving these issues, where if a dispute arises at the local level, it will go up to a higher authority who will sit in the adjudicator chair, essentially, and judge how this thing ought to be resolved. And that raises actually another interesting point about this case, because here we're dealing with a non-hierarchical religious entity, and the Supreme Court has never taken a case that involves a non-hierarchical religious entity when it comes to the church autonomy doctrine. And while, again, I don't think you should read too much into that, some courts actually have, and a handful of courts have actually gone out of their way to hold that if you are not a hierarchical religious entity, that you are excluded from this protection of the church autonomy doctrine. And to me, that is just plainly incorrect. I don't think that the First Amendment is only limited to favor certain types of religion based upon whether you are hierarchical or not. But again, this could just be a chance for the court to clarify on that point, that in fact, that no matter what kind of religion you have access to this same protection under the First Amendment of church autonomy.
Well, Ryan, keeping track of the time here, let me move on to, you know, the next argument that you make, because, you know, it's different, but it's similar in the sense that it's a First Amendment argument. Can you explain how the ministerial exception, you know, just briefly what that is and why it applies in this case, in your view?
So the ministerial exception is sort of, I would say, think of it as being under the umbrella of church autonomy. And the ministerial exception is a sliver of church autonomy that has sort of come into more prominence with a few recent Supreme Court opinions, and that would include the Hosanna Tabor and the Lady of Guadalupe. And what that is about is a church's ability to hire and fire ministers and control who is acting as a minister for a church. And so you've seen disputes arise where sometimes there's someone who is an actual pulpit minister or someone in that kind of role where it's a more clear-cut case with it. And then you're sort of seeing cases now that are trickling up through the lower courts where they're addressing people who are not per se ministers in the sense that you might use that term just in common parlance, but they still have religious functions to their jobs. And so what courts are doing in those cases now is sort of looking at the religious nature of jobs to determine if someone applies for the ministerial exception. This is sort of a broader piece of that. The people who are on the board are not ministers of Bethesda University per se, but they are in leadership, they are governing it, and for that reason, they are expected to conform to the theology of Bethesda University. And so it's related, but this case, I think, implicates this broader doctrine. And I think this broader doctrine is the area that is in desperate need of clarification. The court's silence for 50 years has allowed the lower courts to kind of run amok where different courts are reaching different conclusions. In fact, it's really ironic when you think about some of these circuit splits, kind of how much the courts are disagreeing, because there's not just disagreement at the federal circuit level. There's also disagreement among the state Supreme Courts. And you have some really wonky things that come out of that. For example, if you are in the District of Columbia, if you are sued in the District of Columbia court, it is said that it does have jurisdiction to hear these kinds of cases. It has expanded the neutral principles exception. But if you go to the D.C. Circuit, the D.C. Circuit says no. So literally the same city but your rights are different depending upon where the lawsuit is filed. And the same way in the Eighth Circuit, because I believe it's the Minnesota Supreme Court has also expanded the neutral principles exception. So again, you're in the Eighth Circuit, but your rights are dependent upon if you're getting sued in a state or federal court.
In your petition, have you raised those inconsistencies and conflicts as reasons the court might want to take the case?
Yes, absolutely. And as much as anything, again, clarity is what we're seeking on this and why we think that this case is a good case for the court to do this, because we need to know how this doctrine applies. Is it just for property disputes? Or was that the court just saying that because it had a property dispute before it? And if it is expanded beyond property disputes, how far? Where is that line? And so with our case, what we would think is, even if you were to say that the neutral principle exception could be expanded beyond that, that doing so would need to be done very cautiously, and that the court needs to be very clear about not implicating religious disputes. And I think we've seen the court do this in the property context, where if the court looks at the property dispute and says, this is delving too much into religion, this is delving too much into a doctrinal, a religious dispute, we're not going to get involved in this. The same thing we think would hold true here because of the religious qualifications that are at issue in this dispute.
Yeah. Well, I've got another question that goes back a little bit to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, but it's a good question. So I want to, and you kind of touched on it, but I think there's some opportunity to get deeper into it. And the question is, for non-hierarchical denominations like Pentecostal, for example, how should the courts decide who the highest authority is? You know, how do they do that without then intruding on church autonomy?
So when you're dealing with a non-hierarchical sort of a church or university, I think you have to look at the entity as it stands on its own. I think that that's simply the way to do it. If you have a single church where a dispute arises and the church gathers together and makes a decision about how to resolve a dispute, let's say it's a dispute among the elders of the church, the leaders of the church, and the church decides how to do it, ultimately, that decision of the church has to be respected, that there's no appeal to anybody else. The church just has internally done its own housekeeping and internally has decided how it's going to deal with the issue. And what the Supreme Court has said in other contexts is you're supposed to essentially leave the decision as you find it.
Yeah.
And so that's what we would advocate for non-hierarchical, is if the entity itself has made a decision, that decision ought to be respected.
And that probably also goes back to your wise counsel to, if you've got bylaws, put some of the stuff in the bylaws and avoid problems later. So
yes, you can absolutely, that's the other, you know, you can always learn lessons from things, and that having good bylaws and having clarity on this as a religious institution is always the best way to avoid litigation. But sometimes litigation happens no matter how good your bylaws are and how clear they are. And different people can read the bylaws and reach different conclusions, which you see is exactly what happened here with the California courts deciding that just because it's having to have a theology consistent with Bethesda doesn't actually mean you have to have a theology consistent with Bethesda.
Yeah. We're getting a number of questions, and not surprisingly, about the facts of the case, because the facts kind of do get in the way of the legal issues, just because of the way this case arose. But I think it's good that the questions are being asked, and let's try and answer them. Ryan, in this case, how did Bethesda end up ousting Chow and deciding that Kim board represents Bethesda? I think you outlined that actually in your petition for the court, because court probably some law clerk or somebody somewhere is going to have that same question.
Yeah. As far as how all of this went down. So there were, after the university decided that those people were never eligible, the board, as the university understand it to be constituted, which means to exclude those who were ineligible per se to serve, the Presbyterian members, they reconvened and made a new decision, basically. And after they kept pressing the issue, I mean, as often happens when you're dealing with corporate disputes, the things got pretty ugly, competing people trying to hold competing meetings, and back and forth, disrupting meetings, refusing to attend, and all of this sort of mess. But the Kim board convened, made a decision, and moved forward with that decision, and also made a decision to fire President Chao. And that's sort of where we ended up now, where the Chao board filed a lawsuit once that decision was made.
You know, these are really important legal questions that we're asking and discussing today, but it occurs to me that this is almost a case study in the importance of watching out for mission drift. Has, in representing your clients, has that kind of discussion, without going into attorney-client privilege or anything, is that kind of concern, out there?
I don't think so. What I think happened here is you had people who went to a meeting, and the president basically pulled a fast one on them. They maybe didn't do their due diligence on some of these things about accreditation, which is sort of the hook that the president used to get his people on the board, so to speak, and saying that, diversity is important. And I think we hear that a lot these days. And he was talking about religious diversity and saying, you got to have this if we want to keep our accreditation and, keep us, our ability to stay open. And they went along with that without fully investigating it into themselves. And then later, upon further reflection, they decided that that was a grave mistake that was inconsistent with both their practices since the founding of the university and with their founding documents and their religious beliefs, which is why they took the action that they did to undo that decision.
Yeah. In our closing moments here, you make great legal arguments and some great substantive legal arguments. But as we all know, for the court to grant cert, they've got to be convinced that there's reasons beyond the substantive, law to take the case. What are the arguments that you make to the court on why the court should hear these issues now?
Oh, I would say that this is an issue of national importance, and it has implications beyond just this one university and this one corporate power struggle, as some might characterize the case. It's if this can happen to a religious university, it can equally happen to a religious nonprofit. It could happen to a church, frankly. I mean, if we're really taking the court at its word here and saying that if you have bylaws, if there's something, some tangible document I can look at and interpret, then you've opened the door for courts across the country to begin inserting themselves into religious disputes, which is exactly what the church autonomy doctrine was designed to avoid. It was designed to tell courts that you simply do not have jurisdiction. Courts simply are not competent, I think is even the words that Supreme Court used in 1871 to adjudicate these kinds of things. That is not their role. Courts have a very important role in our society, but adjudicating religious disputes is not one of them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. First Liberty Institute's been, for many years, on the front lines of these First Amendment issues. In closing, do you want to just, for the folks that don't know who First Liberty is, could you tell them a little bit about who they are and what you do there? And maybe we'll use that as a way to bring this full circle and land this interview here.
Absolutely. So First Liberty is a, funny enough, a religious nonprofit. So, maybe I have a personal stake in this case in some ways, but So we handle exclusively religious liberty cases all around the country. We represent our clients on a pro bono basis, and we fight for these kinds of issues, these important First Amendment kinds of issues.
Good. Well, I think this has been very informative. We answered, I believe, all the questions, that were asked by those that are attending. And I know they're recording this for future folks to review, too. And I found it very helpful. And I appreciate that you took the time to do this today.
Absolutely. It's been a fantastic discussion.
Yeah. And maybe we'll turn this back over to the Federalist Society events person.
Well, thank you both for that fantastic discussion and for the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, the audience, for tuning in to us. We greatly appreciate your participation. And on that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.